Hello and welcome to episode 199 of What Most People Think. I hope you're having a good week. I certainly am having a much better week. The last podcast that went up, episode 198, shortly after recording that, I was struck down with food poisoning. You're always struck down with food poisoning, aren't you? Struck down with food. And man, literally, I must have finished the podcast and about an hour later, a couple of people have already suggested having listened back to the podcast that I wasn't quite right then. Could be that. Could have just been that I wasn't being very funny. And I was in a cab on the way over to do my work in progress gig in Stockport. And I had to say to the minicab driver, "Can you pull over, please, mate? This is on a fucking motorway." He looked at me like I was mental and then he saw my face and he was, oh my God, what a scene. I'm just so glad. I won't burden you with the details, but I was not in good shape by the side of the road. And as I was, my system was purging itself, I was suddenly struck with the idea, what if somebody recognised me and took a photo of this? It'd just be the most shameful thing. So I guess it goes to say, you know, you should always, if you've got your health, you should be happy, because one minute you're crushing life, you're having a nice gig, and then the next minute, the next day, there you are by the side of the road, bent over like a fucking sick dog, but thank you to the cabbie who was so nice. I mean, it did occur to me afterwards that after I'd asked him to pull over, and there I was being unwell by the side of the road, he could have just driven off. He's like, "Oh, I don't want this sick bastard in my cab." He could have just driven off. And then I would have been trying to hail a truck driver, and God knows what would have happened then. This is What Most People Think. This is a show, if you're joining us, for our guest this week, who is the... well, you know, a legend of all sorts of things, really. Principally rugby, but also now DJ, author. James Haskell is on the show. We're punching above our weight. And you know why? Remember I said to you about keeping those reviews up? It all helps keep it, you know, the numbers good. And then when you ask people to be on the podcast, and James said yes because he's a nice guy anyway, and we met in other circumstances. But it all helps it, you know, it all helps me basically put good guests. And I've got a very special guest as well for next week for the 200th episode. But if this is the first time listening to this podcast, it's what most people think. It's a comedy, topical discussion chat type fucking thing, you know. One of those things, but it's coming, you know, from a slightly different place politically than a lot of the rest of comedy. Not radically so, but just a little bit. Having said that, though, I'm acting like I'm, you know, the voice of the people. I was at the BAFTAs on Sunday night, and I won't lie, I love hobnobbing with the cultural and liberal elite, but it should be said that me and a writer called Phil, we did duck out of there for a while. To get a pint on tap. So you can never get away from truly from your roots, can you? So we was there. And the thing about these dudes is they always, you know, they generally on the tables, they'll have like wine and champagne. But I think it's very class insensitive that they generally don't have beer and they never have beer on tap. So we went around the corner to an all bar one. Just two guys sitting in an all bar one in our dinner jackets, just drinking pints because we needed a couple of pints. But so usually I'm here to articulate the experience of the common man, but maybe I've got less and less mandate to say that. But getting back to our guest this week, James Haskell, I've had the chat with him. This is look, strap yourselves in. We spoke about a lot of things, you know, obviously from rugby to penises. There was a lot of chat about penises. To DJing, it really, I mean, very smart guy, very funny guy. I mean, he made me laugh as much as any comic coming on the show. So I hope you enjoy that, and that's coming up. Just to say hello to a few new patrons. The patrons are what keep this show weekly and ad-free. At board member level is Dave Lakeland. Dave, I think he's, you know, patrons sometimes kick people out. So Dave is back on the board. He's back on the board. Or well, given it's a board, maybe Dave had to step back for a while, pending a few investigations. Just tying this in with what's happening in the news and a couple of high-profile businessmen. But Dave has been cleared of all charges and he's back on the board. And we all believed in you, Dave. We all believed in you, Dave. We just had to allow due process to happen. We've also got Ed Hanley. Ed Hanley, I think it's a familiar name. Are you a new patron? Ed Hanley. Edward Hanley. I mean, the one thing you would say about that surname now is it sounds dangerously like Hansy. Ed Hansy. Hansy Hanley. Is Hansy Hanley coming? That'd be the worst one, wouldn't it? If you went on a stag do and they'd done T-shirts with nicknames and yours was Hansy. And your wife's like, why do they call you Ed Hansy? You're like, it's just because it rhymes with Hanley. And then she'd go, yeah, okay. But that thought would stay with her. Yes, welcome to being a patron. Remember, if you become a patron, you get all sorts of benefits, not least that you can watch my last free stand-up specials in extended full-length cuts that you can't see anywhere else. I've also got somebody called Kevin Greenhay. Kevin Greenhay. I mean, that sounds like a double-barreled name, but not, if you know what I mean, because there's no hyphen between the two things. Kevin Greenhay. I mean, imagine if Kev Greenhay met with someone with a complicated surname and then became double-barreled. Imagine if he married somebody called Purplestone. Kevin Greenhay and Laura Purplestone. His name, Laura Greenhay Purplestone. This is the problem. The more that you put names together, the more they end up sounding like solicitors. Simon Compton. I mean, I hope. God, Simon, you should become a comedian just so you could have the show title Straight Outta Compton. I mean, just literally for that. Simon Compton. I mean, it's funny, isn't it, that Compton both sounds like, I mean, obviously we associate it with being the hood in America, but it also does sound like a posh item of clothing, you know, is the Compton. I mean, there is a weird interface, isn't there, between American rappers and some real gentlemanly stuff. Like you get American rappers that wear like top hats and drink. I mean, the love of Hennessy as well. It's very, so you sort of get the impression, don't you, that Jacob Rees-Mogg and Method Man would probably get on. And Kevin Thorne, I should plug this, because at the Sudbury Work in Progress show, Kevin and his lovely partner have got, they keep bees, and they've got, I mean, that's a real segue out of nowhere, but they gave me this lovely gift pack, and I know I don't advertise on the podcast, but there's things I'm willing to do for VIP patrons and above. And can I direct you to their website, busybeecosmetics.co.uk. And StourValleyApiaries.com. And they got all this stuff like soap that's got honey in it and stuff. And they got actual honey. It's all this stuff. I brought it home. My wife fucking loved it. So do go and check that out from them. Domain talking point. So this is going back to the names thing. A study in 2020 by Opinion stated that 11% of UK citizens between the age of 18 and 34 combined their last names to create a double-barreled surname upon getting married. So, of course, this is, as you'd expect, a younger thing. So about 10% of them. I guess then, so it would take quite a few generations before we reach tipping point there. But it's just one of those things you've got to do now. I mean, if you're like a Gen Z guy getting married, you can't push back on it, can you? When you just, the whole way you met your missus was going, yeah, I'm a feminist. Go, yeah, Catelyn Moran, yeah. Oh, smash the glass ceiling. And then she says, I don't want to take your name. You're like, you fucking what? You fucking what? How dare you? You make me look like a fool down the local. I look like a fool, Janine. Regarding the council elections, another thing that David has pointed out. So we were talking in the last episode about whether or not who'd had the worst night, who'd had the best night out of Tories and Labour. David says that while Tories definitely had a bad night, it was intriguing to note Labour's results. By Friday evening, Labour had won less than half the seats the Tories had lost. Labour won 450 seats and 19 councils, yet the Tories lost 978 seats and 47 councils. Well, look, like I say, the talk of a coalition between Labour and the Liberals is stepping up. So there's definitely people who have been crunching numbers, and Ed Davey could become kingmaker. That just sounds like the most unlikely thing ever. Ed Davey, kingmaker. I mean, imagine shaping up to be a poor man's Nick Clegg. Okay, a quick thank you and a fuck you before we get into the chat with James Haskell. Thank you. Well, it's a positive development, I think. The Stand Comedy Club, we spoke on the Ian Dale episode about the fact that they'd pulled an event that had Joanna Cherry speaking. They'd originally said they wanted the event to go on, and then enough of their staff said that they weren't willing to staff the event, so the Stand said, but they weren't going to compel people to work. And then, you know, one of the problems when you go up with somebody called Joanna Carey, is that a Q and a C at the end of her name? You can't really do that if somebody holds a view which is not by any means legally, beyond the pale. And so now they've now said that they are going to put, in a surprise development, and that probably involves lawyers, they are going to put the event on. And this is what's interesting, I think, is people often talk about cancel culture, right? And they say, you know, it's not cancel culture, it's consequences culture. I think that we're going to move to a point where there's consequence culture. So you go, okay, that's your consequence, but there's also a legal consequence. You can't do things that are outside of the law. The fuck you goes to Alistair Campbell. In the latest installment of Alistair Campbell appears to have forgotten he's Alistair Campbell. There was a clip of him on Newsnight. He was on with Alex something, the leader of the Reclaim or the Reform Party. I don't know. I can't remember which is which. But so they're having a debate about Brexit. It got a little bit heated, and he said to Alex Phillips, I think her name is, "You're talking nonsense, you know." Well, he was just in a shock development, he decided to be Alistair Campbell. And so he was quite rude to her. Then she came back and he went, he called her my dear or something, which I would say in 2023 is a bold shout to speak to an adult woman in that way. And then the debate got brought to a close by the host, Victoria Derbyshire. And then our boy Alistair, he made a phenomenal decision to tell off Victoria Derbyshire, a senior journalist. He was like, now the thing with you, people like you at the BBC, you bring these people on and you never challenge them. You never challenge them. It was both like really patronising, but also really fucking petulant and childlike. And of course, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, this is, you know, this is who he is. This is always who he's always been. I mean, let's not forget that the character of Malcolm Tucker was built around who he was when he was director of communications at Number 10. I mean, I would say if a modern comic grotesque was based around somebody, that sort of tells its own story. But then, of course, a lot of people backed him up. And this is one of the things with the grown-ups in the room. They just sort of said, well, he's right, though. He's right. Okay, so this is, you know, being a grown-up in the room is actually a curse. It's actually a curse. He has to go around being right all the time. Just so much rightness. And then when somebody isn't right, you know, you sort of understand when he's quite sexist, because it's on account of how right he is. I just think all you have to do is flip that the other way, right? You know, Boris Johnson or Jacob Rees-Mogg says that to a woman, and you would say, well, that was proof undeniably that they're a misogynist and a sexist. But even as I'm saying this, I know that the grown-ups in the room going, oh, but the big difference here is that Boris Johnson wasn't right. You see, think about it as the camera's just... it's just such a burden being a broke grown-up in the room. And they also conveniently ignore how often the grown-ups in the room have just been wrong about stuff. And I would just say, if Alistair Campbell's, one of his main arguments is about the way that the Tories have coarsened public debate, which is pretty rich in itself, I wouldn't then go on telly and patronise the shit out of two women. Okay, enough of all that. Let's get into the chat with James Haskell. This was, I mean, just like I say, strap yourselves in. He's just a smart guy, a funny guy, and exactly what you'd want. He's opinionated. He doesn't hold back. Like a lot of footballers, I would say, seem to modulate everything they're saying through the filter of, will this get me in trouble? No such problems with the brilliant James Haskell. So I'm very pleased to say that joining me on the podcast is rugby legend, DJ legend, podcasting legend, is a lot of legend. It's James Haskell. Welcome to the show, mate.
Hello, Jeff. How are you? It's a great honour, mate. One of my comedy idols and an absolute all-round good lad. So I'm very excited to be invited on your podcast.
Well, you know, the thing is, I feel bad because I haven't always been completely complimentary about rugby, and every time I'm not, I get these angry middle-aged, middle-class blokes. But, you know, middle-aged, middle-class blokes don't get fully angry, but they email me.
They get perturbed. They get riled up. They get ruddy upset.
they get a bit bloody cross at the way
they don't say bloody, they get blooming heck. Yeah. I'll have to have Google guy a piece of my mind if you're not careful.
Well, it's usually because I'm sort of slagging it off from a class point of view, but is that fair with rugby union? Is it more working class than it was, or still?
I don't know. I've got good soundproofing on my detached house and my Range Rover, so I don't know what you lot are talking about.
Fuck them. Yeah, exactly.
Fuck them. Wait, I've seen your sort of four Channel 4 documentaries. I don't know. I think you're always whining about something, are you? Fair pay, yeah. Job opportunities. Fucking give it a rest. Rugby is elitist in lots of ways. I think the game's played by much more of a broader spectrum than you would think. Club rugby's much better, but I think, to honestly, one of the things holding the game back is run by old duffers. A lot of posh people don't really know what they're doing, don't really understand what they're doing. It's held back by all these values. It's just a bit shit, really. I think it's one of those things where ultimately it's always going to have that reputation, because that old shit cliche they say, isn't it? Football's a gentleman's game played by thugs, and rugby's a thug's game played by gentlemen.
What's cricket then? Why is it? I mean, the worst thing for cricket is that it doesn't even have a place in that phrase. And
no,
and cricket is weird.
Cricket's just, I don't know what. I mean, I like the shorter format games of cricket. I do enjoy it. I tried to go to a 5-day. It's very difficult for me because I can't really get behind a sport that I could fall asleep in the stands quite easily, just have a gentle nap during the afternoon. So I quite like high intensity. And I think, unfortunately, the attention span of people is being reduced to about 19 seconds these days. So
That's true, isn't it? If you think about TikTok, but then you also think like our capacity as people to dive into box sets has simultaneously been happening. So on the one hand, we're saying we've got no capacity whatsoever. And on the other hand, we're going 40 hours of succession, please. So is there two things happening? Either it has to be as good as succession to get us to do that, and Test cricket is trying to be more entertaining, or you know, and that's what
I... Look, I think what people say, I mean, look, unless you look at science, I do believe that the fact that digestible content, the scrolling mentality means that certain things we will digest very quickly and not give it a second thought. And we're now perpetually going to continually judge continue to judge a book by its cover, like we always have. We pretend we don't. I think, yes, when people have an engagement and the quality lasts, then people will binge. I think that's right. I think maybe it's different habits in different areas. As I said, I think rugby, could be should be a much bigger sport, but unfortunately, it's just too complicated. People don't understand it. It's not played everywhere, and there is this kind of a tag. Whereas football is a common man sport. You can pick up a football, play it with two jumpers and goalposts. You don't really need to understand it. I mean, the most complicated thing in football that everyone laughs about is the offside rule. Yeah. I mean, like, that's the most basic rule of rugby. Like, that wouldn't even, that wouldn't even worry about anyone. So it wouldn't make anyone sort of be slightly concerned,
Well, what I find interesting with my mates that really do love rugby is you watch it with them and then you sort of ask them to explain refereeing decisions and they don't know, And these are people that love the sport. It is all a bit opaque. I mean, I suppose what's interesting now as well is if you look at, like, if you go back to the 80s, the difference between... the man or woman on the terrace and the person on the pitch, they weren't coming from completely different worlds. But you could say that the difference between people and the super wealthy in football is now exponentially bigger than it is in rugby, as well as people can earn out of rugby. They're not on sort of Galactico type money, are they?
No, not at all. Look, I think the game has become much more kind of... the game is getting bigger, so there's more stars, there's more characters. It's still nothing like it should be. I think that it is, it is a fully legitimate professional sport. It's been professional, not for that long a period of time, to be honest with you, but it's sort of picking up. I think the women's game is now developed, and it's probably developing more so than anything, which is fantastic. And they're hopefully going to build the game in a way that, the men's game didn't do right and learn from a lot of those mistakes. But the money's getting better. And I think the media are taking much more of an interest in rugby as a sport and also as tabloid fodder. There are some characters, but unfortunately they're just not on the same level as footballers, which is a good thing, because somebody, I've been on the side of some bad press, and people sort of looked into things I've done and they're taking interest, but footballers have it way worse because they're just on a bigger scale. There's much more interest in it. You're going to sell more papers if you catch someone out. But I think rugby players are beginning to get that kind of heat. And also because of the class perception, as it were, yes, as I said, there is some validity to it. Because of that, there's nothing like knocking down a couple of ex-public school toffs to sort of, raise a smile for the masses. The emperor
these said, privileged, entitled louts.
Yes, yes. Give the masses bread and circuses, and they will be happy. Hang a posh bloke who played rugby out to dry, and everyone goes, see, I fucking told you that, you know, that those they're all up to no good. Not like our, you know, lovely footballers.
Well, I mean, footballers just got, maybe they've just got better lawyers now. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that about the kind of culture and the laddish components of rugby. When you came on, when I was depping on Times Radio, we spoke about your book. And I think one of the interesting things there is that is the anecdotes, because obviously rugby is fantastic for stories, bawdy anecdotes and stuff like that. How conscious were you writing that book of the need to kind of go, and I'm not saying it's okay, because I call it now these days, you have to do it in comedy, what I call the terms and conditions, but you still want, I mean, essentially what you were sort of saying is, look, I know that I'm not supposed to think this is hilarious, but I know that you also want to read these fucking stories.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You know, your caveat, you have to caveat everything. Everything now comes with, because what happens, especially in comedy, is what you or I say comes out of our mouths and then goes into your filter. So everything I say will go into your filter of your childhood, your current emotional state, the fact that you've been told that you're a special unicorn, unique, and that you can achieve anything in your life, and the fact that now you've got a voice and you can complain about anything. And if you don't like it, you don't just move on. You've now got an opportunity to vocalise that. And so before, it was very simple. I'd hear something, see a comedian, I didn't laugh. If you're a prick, you'd heckle, or that was the end of it. And you would leave a reviewer up to do the review. Now I come out, I didn't like it. I go on social media, like-minded people in the echo chamber of life, they sort of keep that going. And then suddenly, you know, you feel like a special little person, a part of a group, because other people are agreeing with you. You get the endorphins, the dopamine, and then you're suddenly, you know, flying with it. And I think that's unfortunate, whereas, you know, we've got this belief thing that actually feelings are much more important than common sense, and also just difference of opinion. I think that, you know, what I'm not meant to like everything. There isn't a uniform, there isn't a funny thing, there isn't a subject you can laugh about or can't, discuss. I think you have to be very careful about certain things because of, you know, you could be very clumsy around certain difficult topics. Like some comedians can blunder into things and actually don't treat it. But actually, more often than not, it's not about the fact that same people make rape jokes and that kind of stuff. You know, I'd never go anywhere near that because I don't feel like I've got something that would be worth hearing about. I don't think it would be funny, and I think the payoff's not worth it. Some guys, you know, like cancer jokes, like Ricky Gervais, are able to do that because they do it very well, and then it's normally about a juxtaposition between the horrificness of cancer that affects everyone and a funny story about that. You know, when he talks about, you know, he donates a lot of money to charity and he throws the bloke off the machine the first time he got cancer. You know, we've now got ourselves into a situation where we're like, well, that's wrong, I don't like that, you can't have that, you can't say that. You fucking can. You just don't have to like it. And like, just as I don't like certain foods, doesn't mean we have to have one blanket food. And I think we've forgotten that. And because the internet's given a voice to everybody and they don't all deserve it, you know, people will always have freedom of speech, but you weren't able to share that freedom of speech as well as you should. And that doesn't mean it's right. You know, not everyone should be able to shout the rooftops everything they think. You should be able to say what you think, but in the closeness of your own home. Like, if you want to be racist, you know, you're a dickhead, but if you want to be racist, you can shout at your nan, you can shout at your dad, you can shout at your mum in your living room. You just can't, you shouldn't be able to go onto a global platform and allow your opinion to filter behind everything and then say it's freedom of speech. So when I wrote the books with all these stories in them, I was aware that I was like, right, is it the truth? Yes. You know, can I write it in such a way that it's clear that I obviously know that it probably wasn't the best thing, but it still happened. It's still funny. It's still,
was of its time.
Of its time. But and of its time is a very good point. You know, we are where we are now because we improved on the standards that were then. You know, you don't go around pulling down statues and blaming stuff that happened then. If we're doing it now, then you've got a point. You've got a point. You can go, oh, listen, this person is still influential now. He got it wrong and we're still doing shit now. Be better now. Sort things out now. Life's now. Don't go, oh, 10 years ago you did this, you don't do it now, but we're still going to hang you for it. It's like fucking, that's just stupid. It's like we've got history to learn from. And so I think with the books, over time, you know, this was probably a bit more liberal, but actually there is still a universal thing that I was a dickhead, that I'm quite happy to say I was a dickhead. I acted like a fucking clown. I had a lot of fun doing it. You know, is it palatable to everyone? No. Do I want to be palatable to everyone? No. Is what everybody does palatable? No. So don't fucking worry about it. And so the thing is that I kind of broke the mold with that book because I kind of just was able to be truthful without sort of being overtly controversial and kind of owning it.
I mean, there were some parts of it that are memorable with the book. I particularly, there was a story about the guy, I think he was a physio called The Rope. He had a nickname of The Rope.
Yeah, he had
a massive penis, basically, a freakishly large penis. This is one of the things I think is interesting about sportsmen is that you see more penises, you know, on a more regular basis than anybody.
Someone reminded me of this quote. I was with one of the crew who was filming Good Bad Rugby yesterday because we were away doing anything in Ibiza, said to me that on a plane, I stopped him and I said, I stopped him and went, do you know what? I have seen an inordinate amount of penis, right? Yeah. And then they went, what? And I went, well, I've just realised this. From the age of 7 years old to 35, I've showered with men every day.
Yeah.
But give or take, right? Or some of it's my private life, some of it's my, you know, but give or take, like prep school, communal showers, right? Public school, team showers, post showers, some were a bit more private. Professional rugby player, communal showers. Just penis.
So are we saying then that a rugby player that went to like prep school and stuff is probably pound for pound going to see more penis than anyone else alive?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a few, you know, there's probably a few people we could put on the list without, but I don't want to get myself cancer. Probably a few people on the list you could throw in there that have had a good go at it. But the caveat to that would be that they actively wanted to see them. You know, I'm not squeamish. Like I was talking to someone about some LGBT plus Q stuff in regards to kind of homophobia, and I always love the sort of backwards common man concept that if your mate was gay or your teammate was gay, the first thing he always goes, but I'll be a little bit concerned if in the shower, okay, so looked, and I always turn around and say, listen, mate, you're fucking hanging whether I'm gay or straight. Like, it doesn't matter. Gay men don't suddenly just lose their eyesight. It's the same way as not every woman wants to have sex with you. Just because if I went gay, I still wouldn't shag you because you're hanging, right? So not you, I mean, but just the general you. And so I find that very funny. But yeah, pound for pound, I've seen just...
And seen some legends. Seen some legends out there. I mean, it is. I think that, you know, Catherine Ryan always says that she thinks that men are in a way more interested in penises than women. And I think that there is something about the mythical power of the incredibly well-hung man. It's almost like a captain that we march behind. You know, we need to know that there's one in our team. I mean,
the rope. The rope had such long penis that when he was 14, he used to be Great Britain wrestler. His wrestling coach in the shower, like just laying out the shower, just like talking, looked in and went, went, Bobby, has your dad seen that? Right. It was that fucking big, right? Yeah. And mate, you know, the rope had magic healing powers. So if you ever had an injury, he would come out and nowhere and ask you, mate, do you need rope? And you'd be like, yeah, Bob, I need rope. And he'd hit his penis on your injury and it would feel markedly better. He could also hit a full can of Red Bull sealed off a table with it. And he obviously had all the penis through the puppetry, but it was tall and long. I mean, you know, he was a very impressive man. Now, I would say that Catherine Ryan is probably right in regards to, you know, men forget that a penis is like probably not that amazingly attractive. If you look at it, both vaginas and penises, if you were to take them in the cold light of day and you weren't to know what they were for and you were just to show an alien, they're not really that good looking. Like sometimes, you know, we make it good looking. Like if you see a vagina, you're like, wow, that's a good vagina. Like that's a good vagina out of the vaginas you've seen out of the concept of, you know.
Yeah, tidy. You know, I think a good vagina is sort of, you know, those really kind of like good storage solutions. Where it all folds, ego. Well, that is it. Well,
yeah, that's excellent. Yeah. That folds away nicely, seamless, right? But you know, nothing hanging out. But the thing with it is that you would then. But if you were going to design something to like not be great, it would be a fold of skin in the body. If you were going to grow something that could like harbor bacteria and smell, it would be a skin pocket in your body, right? So, but then you think about it, it's rank a penis. You look at them. The first thing men do online, you know, gay or straight or whatever you're into. You know, the first belief is they get a bit horned up and they're like, oh, I'm going to send this because they're going to love it, right? With the expectation that a girl or a man's going to open and go, fucking hell. I was having my tea, but now I've seen that. I'm like, oh, what's your name? Can you come around and bang me? Whereas especially with women, they get bombarded with penis shots and some of them are hanging. And I'm like, I just don't know what the men think is going to happen. Because in their mind, they're so clouded by testosterone and horniness that they genuinely go, oh, shit. When she sees this, and I guarantee you will knock one out, come, and then be like, oh, my God.
Well, I think that what I've learned over the years with women is penises, like, it's very much a context thing. You know, like, there's certain foods that you've really got to be in the mood for. It doesn't, the moment you take the context away, it's almost abstract, the value of a penis. I mean, yes. I was writing, it's right in the book that I've got coming out, I was writing about balls, you know, as well. Yeah. Is I've always been, you know, like, we talk about men checking their own balls. One of the reasons I don't, and I should, but I'm just being honest, I don't, and I should. I think they're so weird, right? And this is what I've got.
I don't play with them, but I don't, as a thing,
yeah.
Testicles, they don't really serve, well, they obviously have a great purpose, but they don't feature in my daily life. But because I'm now that age, I'd say two or three times a week, I'd check them just to see.
I've got to check them, haven't I? Yeah, no, I've got to check them. But they just, it's the vulnerability of them. You know, it's sort of like, and I think I say this in the book, but I was sort of, you know those animals that choose to live on the side of a cliff?
Yes.
And you think, well, why the fuck would you live there? I think that about balls. I think it's an incredible, essentially they've got the balls to be balls. Maybe that's why they're a metaphor for courage.
But you know what, you do know why they hang outside the body to keep it cool. You know that, don't you?
Yeah, you know, I guess they ended up like, well, this is the only place we can live. We've got to a point.
Yeah. So it's like a conservatory. It's like a conservatory that, yeah. You know, but it's a temperature-controlled conservatory on the side of your house where they're like, look, you know, but, for evolution, your sperm actually can't survive at extreme temperatures. We need to put it in a cooling system outside the body. I know what we'll do. We'll put it in a sack with two blowing things, and then we'll just put, and then they'll be quite weird, and some will be big. I mean, I've got a friend who's, I mean, talk about Pete. I mean, you know, I sound like an expert. Maybe I could get an honorary doctorate, like Imperial.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen people with balls that you'd look at them and think they've got elephantitis. Like, I remember seeing one guy, they were so big. He had to shower with his pants on. Like, and there's another guy that's a very famous England player. There's an actually internet photo on the internet, I won't name and shame, but he actually he got them stamped on, right, during a game, and they got ripped open. And he had to go and one of them's bit testicles hanging out, had to get stitched back up. Mm. I mean, to be fair, the bloke was probably just going for his leg, but the chance of him hitting his ball was you know, way, way bigger than hit his leg. And they're huge, huge. And I'm not a big ball man. I don't, you know, but I would check them because I think it's just one of those things where I've had a couple of mates who had testicular cancer and cut stuff. And for want of just checking them, it's worth it.
It's interesting because we know when you listen to your podcast, you seem to be able to go seamlessly from, you know, being blokish and stuff like that into, you know, having a message as well at the same time. Mm. We know that footballers, people like Marcus Rashford and stuff like that, have become vehicles for, you know, social justice in some respects and causes. To what extent is that happening in rugby? Are rugby players getting courted saying, oh, you should be talking about this, or you haven't really taken a position on that?
I think the first thing is that, I mean, what Marcus Rashford does is brilliant. I think it's something that he is passionate about. You know, there are things that agents and people try to retrofit onto people that don't have that, hate this word, but that kind of, what is the word? Not honesty, but...
authenticity.
Authenticity. That's the one everyone throws around. Authentic. Is it authentic? Is it authentic? Mm. You know, Marcus Rashford has a real authentic feel to what he's doing. He obviously cares about it and he's good at it and he's driven change. I think it's very, very dangerous to get involved in things that have no authenticity to you that you don't fucking care about, because A, you won't put the effort into, B, you will get found out. And I think, you know, the problem again with a lot of stems back from social media and the thing of opinion is, just as if my wife posts about, right, here's a recipe, right, for pancakes, and someone go, well, what about a vegan fucking recipe? What about this? What about that? What about people who don't like milk? What about people who are fat? What about people who are thin? What about, and then you've got a caveat, right? So what she just posted is, look, this is just talking to these specific members of the public. This is nothing to do with it. It's the same thing with me. I made a stand about a former, well, he's a still current player, fantastic player, incredible player, who is overtly religious, and with some of that religion comes that backward thinking of chastising certain members of the society. Basically, he said that gay people are going to go to hell, right? And I thought, fucking hell, you know, whatever your beliefs, whatever God, whatever you believe in, it's all bollocks anyway. But whatever you do, I respect it. Like, you know, just, but there'll be young men who are struggling with their sexuality who will look at you as a hero and you just condemn them to hell. Yeah, and if their idol, who is a good looking, super talented sportsman, says a gay, it's just fucking, you know, you just don't need to do it. I stood up to him, got massively bashed. And I do find it's quite funny that I found that I did religious studies at school from 8 to fucking, I don't know, 15, 16. And I had a friend who was very religious. He took me to Bible schools and all this kind of stuff. I never drank the Kool-Aid, but I sort of know about it. And it's very interesting. They always turn about kind of being forgiving and turning the other cheek. I've never met a group of more unforgiving bastards than super religious Christians and whatever. They literally are like vicious with it across it. You know, like hence you see religious wars. It's like, we love God, we talk about peace, but fucking agree with us or I'll kill you. And I remember coming out and saying that I thought this was wrong. And I've never had so many people come and go, well, where are you when the, you know, where are you when they're, you know, they're throwing when the Muslims are doing this, or you're throwing, or the gay people being thrown off a building, and I'm like, listen, I'm not here to fight everyone's fucking battles. I've got an opinion about something that I felt strongly about at this particular time. I'm not walking around going trying to correct the world. And I think unless something becomes in rugby that will encourage, you know, that for example would make you, you know, feel like you have a valid impact, then I would do that. I think rugby players are starting to do that. I think some of them have gone down the path of the region's gone, fucking hell, Rashford's, you know, on the way to a knighthood.
Yeah, that's what I think. Does that happen? They must get, because like people who front up charities and stuff like that, it must be quite, especially with the most high profile footballers. It's like all things. I mean, we're probably both of us. The longer you get in this game, the more different strands of showbiz that you interface with. You see what the game is as such. And if someone has a voice and a platform, they're going to get courted. So I guess what we're saying is that some of them are kind of, I guess they get pitched to in a way. Maybe it should be like Dragon's Den, but for...
Yeah, retro. Can we retrofit a scheme onto you? But I've had that before where they're like, you know, would you like to do this? I'm like, no, I don't. But it's a great cause, but I don't fucking care. I don't.
You hate, like, you hate poor people. Why would you stick up for poor people?
That's what I mean. I don't want to raise money for them. No. You know, can't we give tax breaks to the rich like we all deserve?
Finally, like, you know, someone's speaking up for it.
but no, so I think, you know, I do a lot of stuff with children's charity. So a charity called Sebastian's Action Trust, done stuff with Bernardo's, and I've also done stuff with Matt Hampson's charity and Restart, right? Basically, because they are all things that I care about. Everyone has a cause, right? Obviously, poverty and cost of living is horrific. I obviously care about it. I care about those things, but I don't immediately affect them. I don't feel that I could, what I feel passionate about is, for example, Restart is, you know, catastrophic injury to professional sports players on restarting your career. You know, most people don't have to retire, you know, they retire once in life. You retire twice, you've got no discernible skills, you wrecked your body, you know, you give them no financial aid. There's obviously all the issues associated with the sport. That was one charity. Sebastian's Action Trust was a charity of a young boy that my parents met, and who met his parents, sat at a dinner. He sadly passed away, but all he ever wanted to do was go on holiday. But he had a terminal illness. You couldn't go on holiday because of all the palaver, the medical stuff. So they built this care home called Bluebells, and that was an opportunity for families to go into the country, a home from home, close to emergency services, had everything on hand, but could have some normality. And I was like, fucking hell, I am so lucky to have done what I've done as a kid. I came from a privileged background. I wanted for nothing. I did have a lot of hardship, more so than anyone else. And I got to achieve what I wanted to achieve. So many kids don't make it past their birthday. So many kids die in birth. So many people aren't afforded that thing. And I think, you know, I'm not saying that human life is weighed up, but, you know, if you're 90 and something happens, you've had a good fucking go. And it's sad, always sad. Always sad. And anything unfortunate happening, sad. But when a life is taken away young, I mean, that's why I don't believe in God, because, you know, you can't tell me that somebody kills 3 million children under five every year, you know, and just claims he's working in mysterious ways, is a God that I would want to get involved in, whatever, which one everyone is, because I think...
But maybe he's just like us. He's like going, I can't do everything, lads. You know what I mean? I've only got I can only save the people I give a shit about. You know what I mean?
Just stop killing kids. That'd be the first bit. I'd just go, I'll tell you what you should do. Just, you know, you made the world in 7 days. You remember you made all the stars and the planets, right? And then the next day you said, let there be light. And you did it in the dark, which is the most impressive thing. And then you went and you made a man out of clay. Just stop, put all that shit down. Get rid of cancer for kids, get rid of leukemia for kids, get rid of all that stuff, and then you can carry on doing what you're doing. That's all I'd ask. Just do that.
Get rid of cancer. Yeah, it seems
Kill the devil. Just do that because you made the devil because you make everything. Why cut? Just kill the devil. But anyway, that's too complicated because they can't do that because there's a plan and we're all part of that.
I like the kill the devil thing. It is kind of weird that he hasn't taken him out. If you think about if there is some sort of celestial kind of special ops thing, you go, this guy has been most wanted for a while. He's been just causing shit for a long time now.
He made the oceans, right? Mm. And all the land. And then he just went, filled it with animals, just as he wanted it to do. You're telling me that so if you believe the Bible, the devil's a fallen angel. God made the angel just go like that, boop, squash him. Then there's no more devil, but he can't do that. So again, it's all man-made nonsense because it just doesn't make sense. It's just people trying to find purpose and an explanation in this mad world that we somehow found ourselves in. But I would say most of the things I care about are with kids and kind of, certain passion projects. So you will not see me trying to retrofit a thing because I think people could do it better. You know, Marcus Rashford has genuinely, profoundly changed people. And in this cost of living crisis where people have got to decide whether to heat the house, feed their kids, you know, hopefully some sort of form of food and aid is there. But unfortunately, like everything in life, it's very easy for me to say on my ivory tower, you're just moving a pot of money round or solutions round for people. And I think it's made even worse when you find out how much the government's wasted on stupid pet projects or line their pockets with. But unfortunately, I think there's always going to be the haves and the have-nots, and it's where you can most make your mark. And I think someone like him has done a profound job.
I think, I don't know if you noticed, you know when you do like celebrity quiz shows and stuff like that, one of my favourite moments is when the host says, and what are you raising money for? And the celebrity says their thing. And like obviously like with yourself, if you say a kids charity, everyone's great, cancer, everyone's great. Every once in a while, there's a charity where people go, that sounds like a fucking waste of time. Yeah. And they go like something like, well, there's a retired donkey sanctuary in Eastbourne. And you go, okay, fair enough. Yeah, donkeys. Yeah, I guess
this is controversial. I reckon of all the things I said that this is most because I love animals, right? I love animals. Yeah. Big dog, like I love it. Cruelty to animals is awful, but I've got to say, right, the outrage on the internet of someone hurting an animal. Bear in mind there are children dying, being abused, being sold, malnourished. Everything. Humans are so good. Are just ignoring one part of it, switching their mind off, because everyone lives in a bubble. Look, unless you are on the forefront of any of the extremes you're talking about, we all live in a bubble. You know, that's why when you drive past a car accident, if you actually see part of the accident, then you're like, fuck me. You know, these cars aren't that safe. And actually the human body is very fragile. And actually, you know, that's why these first responders, I'm amazed by, because you see the fragility. As a man, you like to think you're quite tough. You know, people... Your arms get ripped off, shit gets, it's terrific. The human body's very fragile. Life is very fragile. So when people go, wow, you know, I'd save the dog over this, you're like, look, I know it makes you feel easier because animals can't really talk back to you, but you're kind of ignoring all the children suffering, all the actual problems with humans. And I would say that, I'm not saying one's better than the other, but I would say human life is much more important than animal life.
Well, I guess we have a sense of our, and I think the fact that we can perceive our own suffering and narrativize it does put in as, yeah. And so, yeah, if anyone wants to email in, yes, I do fucking hate dogs. Hate dogs.
You know, you see it. I would say, look, you know, if you've given a lot of money to somebody and you want to give money to a dog charity, then that's fine. I just, animal life is not worth more than a human life. And I think until we have sorted out all the problems that face humans, you know, and if I think you should prioritize that, you know, but don't, I'm not saying you don't help dogs, charities, animal charities, you should. Mm. But I think if you're a poor call, if you only got £20, that's the only £20 you're ever going to give it to something that's going to help a human. If you've got more than £20, feel free to give it who you want. But if you get, you know, save a dog, save a human, I'd save a human because for all the reasons you just said. But I was on that, that someone stopped me in the street and I now pay, what was it, a tenner a month for like Battersea Dogs Home or whatever. I'm still doing it now. I mean, I get pictures of like dog and I love it. But I also do the same thing with children's charities. But I'm not in that privileged position to be able to do that. I just mean the people who are so vitriolic about anyone who hurts an animal versus humans.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Like the character of Tony Soprano in the very first episode of The Sopranos, he's feeding the ducks, isn't he? And there is that correlation. I'm always slightly alarmed when people want to overstress their love of animals too, because like when they sort of like, so, you know, I'd rather spend my time with animals than humans. I think, well, you've got issues then. Like that's not how it's supposed to. Well, yeah, you could. I mean, a dog is a creature. I've got two dogs and I love them, but I think part of loving something is seeing it for its flaws. And one of them is a thieving bastard and the other one is a narcissist, right? And that is real love. That is what they are. This isn't some fucking like charitable endeavor. They're here and they're nice to me because I give them food and I take them for walks. And that's fine, right?
But rest assured, they'd eat you if you died and there was nothing around.
If they ever realize their collective power, like dogs, that's why I'd never have more than two in the house. Because if they wanted to stage a mutiny, big ones as well.
No, I mean, I'm one of those people that won't walk past a dog without saying hello to it, talking to it. Any cute animal, anywhere, I hold it. Birds, I don't care. I love animals. Like Chloe bollocks me because on holiday, I'm like, oh, look, there's an animal. Look at that bird. Look at that crow. Look at this, whatever. And I, you know, snake, I don't care. But the thing with it is you always see certain type of people on the internet when they've got more pictures of dogs more pictures of animals than themselves, you know that they're not very comfortable with the way they look. And you also know that they're desperate for love. And you also know they have found the love in an animal that they can project what they think onto it.
Daddy, do you know, of all the things we've ever spoke about in this podcast, I guarantee that's the one that's going to get some of the biggest pushback. All right, I hope you're enjoying the chat with James there. I hope you've got some great mental images there, probably to do with rope. Just a reminder, you can pre-order my book, The British Bloke Decoded, which is now, it's in, it's done, it's written. Pre-order it, please read it, please, please. Okay, if you haven't, have you ever given me a 5-star review for this podcast, you can do that, that would be good, but you could just order the book. My argument is, if you're going to eventually get it, why not pre-order it? All right, please pre-order it. And also, just some tour dates to give a little tickle to. Lincoln Drill Hall, I'm at, on the 16th of September. I'm in Halifax on the 21st of September. That's a weird part of the world, isn't it? Halifax, Leeds, Bradford. That bit of the M62 has got so many big fucking towns there, and they've all got different accents and strange cultures. And I'm sure I've never done a tour show in Halifax, but there'll probably be some weird thing afterwards where they have to sacrifice me to the Northern Gods. Peterborough, the 28th of September. Carlisle, Wednesday the 18th of October. I'm in Dundee on the 18th of November. And I'm also in Belfast on the 24th of November. And then Dublin on the 25th of November. And I promise you, if you come along, I will do the accents. I'll do my Belfast. How's my Belfast? What about you, wee man? You're right there, wee man. You almost have to shout a little bit just to get into it. Get into the thing with accents is that I used to be good at them, but I can't go for more than a sentence now, which is sort of like my sexual prowess. I could start fine and then Dublin and the Dublin accent. I normally get my head around it by going by the banks of the Liffey, I'll be there in a jiffy. This is just culturally insensitive. This ain't selling any tickets, is it really? 2024, there's new dates. There's an extra date in Bristol in the Redgrave Theatre. That's already sold quite a few. I'm going to be in Mansfield. I'm going to be in Loughborough. I mean, doing shows, by the way. I'm not just going to be fucking lurking around there. And I'm also going to be in King's Lynn. First ever tour date in King's Lynn. So do buy tickets for that. And now let's get back to the chat with James Haskell. So I want to talk about DJing because this is a rare opportunity for me on this podcast. I mean, the listeners will often hear me say I went out for a day party here somewhere, and you know, like the sort of self-styled sad veteran clubber hanging on in there. But you are essentially sort of living my dream, really, is that you did one thing and you are now like a DJ producer. I mean, it's incredible. How long this has been a part of you? You know, were you into your house music way back in your rugby days and stuff?
Yeah, so the story about me and music was I started seeing a sports psychologist when I was 17 to help with performance. And the first thing she talked about was how to consistently perform for 30 games a season. You know, back in the day, you could do it for 8 games a season. You could do anything on emotion first time round, but you have to do anything repeatedly. You need to find some structures in place. And she talks about the emotive power of music. We hear a song that changes our state. So where energy goes, where focus goes, energy flows. So, you know, you're having a shit time, you listen to a shit song, it's awful. If you break up and you turn on Magic FM in your car, you're just driving straight into a wall, crying, screaming, going, I hate you. If you break up and your favorite song comes on, and like, my, you know, whatever it is, Michael Jackson, you feel like, yeah, I'm absolutely fucking loving life here. Fuck her or him or whatever. You'll be fine. And I think, you know, that's a kind of a flippant way of doing it. But with rugby, if I had a playlist of songs when I heard them, they emotionally made me feel good, believe in myself, recall times that I had performed well. And you'd obviously update that. And I started to do that. And I would every 3 months would change my playlist. I found as soon as I put my headphones on to prepare for a game, I was ready. Whatever state I was in, tired, upset, had an argument with my partner, I was ready to go. And I was, when I first started, I was the only player with headphones on the bus. Bear in mind that everyone's got headphones on, Beats by Dre, everyone. But, you know, back in the day, I was the only one. So much so, it used to upset people. They used to go, look, what are you listening to? Can you get, you need to concentrate, you're not listening. Now people listen to it. And so I always had understood the power of music. My tastes, when I first started, I think I had like Walking Memphis, Coldplay, Oasis, all that kind of stuff. And then I started going to Vegas. I started going to Ibiza, Vegas more than anyone. Go to the pool parties. Someone sitting at the front of the pool with a DJ deck, DJing. Everyone having a great time. Him or her controlling the entire mood of the vibe. I'm in a massive attention seeker. I clearly love the sound of my own voice, as the listeners will get a guess or figured out. Why would I not want a DJ? I love technology. I'm a proper nerd for computers, for laptops, for drones, for bits and pieces. So it was the perfect calling, really. And then I started to go to Ibiza as well, started to get that vibe. Obviously, all this was kind of, you know, non-drug taker. I was kind of just like alcohol and kind of going and experiencing that kind of life. And I just absolutely loved it. And so I did a course from a now defunct school. And at the end of the course, I think it was like 3 months, I did lots of one-on-one lessons. If you were good enough, you got to DJ at Ministry of Sound on the balcony. I did it. I just was like, wow, I love this. It filled all the boxes of being a player, and now in retirement, being a rugby player, in terms of preparation, intensity, jeopardy, the performance aspect, the adulation from the crowd, and the fact you've got the emotive power of the music. Those kind of things get into a heady mix of like, wow, this is a perfect kind of box ticker. I then, you know, got an agent. Agent was like, right, he's a bit of a dickhead. He was like, why are you... why'd you get into DJ? And I said, because I love playing music. It's good because you won't earn any money. And then he booked me to pay my first gig for $3,000. And I was like, mate, that is a fucking ton of money. Like, you know, this will be fine.
Yeah.
So I have a DJ. Anyway, I'm not with him anymore. But he said, listen, I think you should maybe try and get a radio show or do your own podcast, set that up. Then they were like, oh, I think you're being held back because you don't make music. So I was like, all right, fuck you. I'll go and do a production course. Started making music, started working with engineers. So basically my journey has been born out of people telling me I'll never be able to do it. Can't do it, shouldn't do it, laughed at me. And I've now just booked 13 dates in Ibiza. I've got my first residency in Ocean Beach starting on Monday. I've got my eighth track's coming out in August. My seventh was out on Torum Records 2 weeks ago. So man, I'm very happy with it. Again, it's a perfect tool to replace playing. The lifestyle is very difficult in regards to
Well, that's
travel.
One thing that I wanted to ask is like, how hard is the obviously you're in a party environment where all those things are available and common. How hard is the managing what time you get to bed? But I mean, luckily, you know, there are a lot more daytime parties now, but I've never got my head around how, if your set time is 3 a.m. is what the preparation is like. Do you go to bed for a little while and then set the alarm, or is it, you know, or do you just try and stay up?
So to be honest with you, there's a couple of times where I've basically, I would sleep and go and wake up. It's always horrible though, because it's, you know, you sort of, unless you've got a tour manager, which I now have at the times, but you'd be fearful of missing that, the wake up, so you don't really sleep. You know, it's like when you have to get up early for an airport, you set like 8 alarms. The hardest bit is because, you know, if you've ever gone, and that which you had a late night, but you're not drunk, you still wake up feeling as shit minus sleep. Not as shit, you're not throwing up on your hands and knees, you know, praying, but you know you sort of feel pretty bad, and you get sort of almost hungover with lack of sleep. That's a problem, you know. Then you couple that with travel and on planes and inability to sleep and the adrenaline post a show, you just don't get a great night's sleep. And then, you know, you obviously want to train, so your training takes a dip. You're obviously nutritionally you can sort of get it right in the day, but eat, you know, get working later into the evening, you know, if you eat around that period of time. Also the alcohol, everywhere you go people are having a party, you want to have a party, you're sort of on that vibe. So you can see why people get lost down the rabbit hole. I think for me, if you can be disciplined between that, not bite off more than you can chew, take care of your health, and make those choices, I think it's easier to manage. But again, I'm not at the level, you know, someone like a Nick Fanciulli, you know, I spoke to him the other day, and he, you know, he'd been Ibiza, DJed 4 till 7 in the morning, right? Which was like a mad set time, you know, finishing off the day, goes, has a day off, flies in, changes suitcase, flies to Dubai for 24 hours, comes back. You know, that's going to have a take a toll on you. You know, they looked at your, if you sleep in less than 5 hours a night, it's something like you'd have to fact check this, but from overhearing conversation my wife was having with someone, it kind of raises your risk of dementia and Alzheimer's by 50%, that kind of sleep deprivation continuously. And so,
well, yeah, and also it's not sleeping at night when humans are supposed to sleep.
Yes. And you end up altering your circadian rhythm about when you want to sleep and stuff. And I think you can change it and manage it, but again, it's not good for you. So that's why you've got to pick and choose, you know, what you do with. But I am probably the most unhealthy and unfit I've been in my entire career. And I had to have a word with myself the other day in regards to like sleep, trying to do too much. Because I was in Ibiza for 2 days, flew back to London, had a night at home, flew to Jersey, DJed 12 till 2 in the morning, flew to London, DJed at Studio 338 for Fat Tony, 5 till 7, went to bed, flew out on the Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, DJed twice on the Tuesday in Amsterdam, flew back on the Wednesday. And by the time I got back on Wednesday, I was shaking, had a fever, and I was like, and I hadn't even done anything. I wasn't even out, my, you know, I hadn't even drunk. I literally tried to be professional, but I just wasn't sleeping. Hotel room, shit. And I just couldn't deal with it.
It is interesting, the British house scene. I sometimes wonder, you know, of all the strands of music, it doesn't really get the respect it deserves. I mean, one example of that, when the Brit Awards removed it as a category for quite a while. Yeah, and I mean, it was just, but also what I found with dance music is that the acts that tended to get respect were the sort of middle-class friendly type festival acts. Like, great acts.
You love the old class war, don't you? Like,
I try to stoke it wherever I can. But I mean, people like Groove Armada and Chemical Brothers, who are absolutely brilliant. But it seemed like the only people that were worthy of awards, when you've got, I mean, you mentioned Tool Room there. How is Mark Knight not an OBE? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There are these people. I mean, you look at comics, you've already mentioned the miles that people clock up. People like Nick Fanciulli, Mark Knight are performing to thousands of people every fucking week. There's not like a footballer or a cricketer that has a closed season. They just do it all the time.
No, I agree. And look, and actually talking to Mark Knight, he is one of the most brilliant individuals that I've met. I mean, I got to know Mark probably about a year ago now. I did a Tool Room course a couple of years, 3 years ago when I started my production. Pete Griffiths and the guys over there, amazing. Tom, Ben Remember, fantastic sort of teachers, and I absolutely loved it. And I got to meet Mark, and in any walk of life involving the arts, you get people a little bit wanky, a little bit ethereal, bit up their own arse, they talk riddles, they're, you know, they're very disingenuous, and because it's a very vacuous, self-loving world, of course it is. But he was just the most genuine, down-to-earth bloke I've ever met. As soon as I was like, he was one of us straight away. I went, right, like, he's helped me more than anybody's helped me in the last 8 months. He's been brilliant. He's been supportive. He's been kind. He's a good laugh. And we just pissed ourselves. And he's utterly brilliant. And then I got to see him for the first time live, because I'd listened to mixes, watched YouTube, but I'd never seen him live the other day. And you can see why he's one of the biggest international DJs, mate. The way he kept the intensity, the pace, the energy of the set, and the skill, mate, it was just
brilliant. Well, what's interesting is I know the kind of people who listen to this podcast. They're a great audience, but they will, right? As we're talking, they'll be going, fucking DJ.
I don't listen to lyrics. I've listened to songs and Chloe goes, do you hear the lyrics? I don't listen to it. I'm all about the beat. And so I never really paid attention. She was like, that song you really like, you know, it's really sad and dark. I was like, is it? And then I started listening to the words. Like, oh, God, it's about a fucking breakup. It's about this, it's about that. And so I think house music for me is I can work to techno, right? Because I just like the beat, you know, the different things and the skippier percussion, the garagey percussion in house music is what I like. It's what I'm making. I like the bit as soon as you hear it, you're like, oh, pull that little face, your shoulders start going. And I think for me, it's much more the rhythm that is, you know, and I think before people could sing, you know, I'm again, this is probably, you know, someone from fucking Natural History Museum might be able to put me in the right direction. But I'm sure we were banging shit, you know, eventually when we discovered fire, sitting around and singing and making instruments. And beat was so important versus the lyrics. Now we've added the emotion of the lyrics on top of it. I think that's the difference. And, you know, it doesn't really matter what they say in a house song. You know, like Cola, was essentially talking about MDMA. But essentially, she can't taste what it is yet. You know what I mean? Like, just has one sip of a Coca-Cola. I think, what I mean? It's like a bit odd.
Is that what that song's about? I did not realise. Yeah. I mean, does dance music always struggle from the thing? Because I'm aware that people will go, and look, obviously you're not as middle-aged as I am. But that's the problem, is when we talk about it, I mean, like, can you just corroborate to the listener that the average age for people that still go clubbing has gone up? Because I suppose, I don't really understand, in a way, why the daytime thing took so long to become a thing. But that is that where you're seeing the biggest area in growth, in terms of events, stuff happening during the day?
Yes, I think events, I mean, Defected is a label. Simon Dunmore, again, brilliant guy, been fantastic, helpful to me. Really, a lovely bloke. What Defected did with their events and the things they pioneered, there is a real appetite for people to go out there, dance and to party. I think on the continent, especially around Spain, Italy, the culture is to go out to dinner at like fucking 11 o'clock and the party starts at 4 in the morning. They've always culturally done that, That's why Music On with Marco Carolla and, Circo Loco and all those other bits and pieces like DC10, they love that kind of vibe. I think people value their sleep. I think life's a bit more stressful. People are more busy, in inverted commas. So day parties are good. I think there is a real appetite for day parties. And I think they're getting bigger and bigger. I think it's down to,
Is it just for old fuckers like me that want to get to bed?
I just think it's very interesting. So I'll give you an example with the Ocean Beach thing coming up recently. I was thinking about kind of what I want to play, and some people will go to see DJ. So I would go and see Fred again out of because I want to see him perform. I think it'd be amazing. I would look at a lineup at a festival. I would go and see the DJs I want. Some people go to a party irregardless of who's playing, because like an Ocean Beach, for a lot of people, it's the Instagram, it's the party, it's the social. Unless there is a really specific DJ, they're just there to have a tear up. They don't really give a fuck. They're not there to be educated on music. Go to see Fat Tony at Full Fat Brunch. It's classic house and disco. You are going to see Fat Tony. You are going to have a dance, dress up in flowers and get Prosecco out your mind. You go to Glitterbox, it's classic house and disco. That's what you're looking for. And I think there are probably a big seam of events where it's just people on the piss. It's more opportunity to go out and get pissed up than it is to listen to the music. But I think because of streaming and the easy access of so much music, you are now finding more fans, finding certain DJs and getting more access to DJs. And someone like Fisher, who's one of my DJ idols, and I met him, and he's a fucking hero. He is a performer. He is as a pop star, as much a pop star as a DJ, because he performs. People come to see Fisher because his music's on point, his mix is on point, but there's the theatrics that go with it. And people will have found that and go and follow him and go and see it. Hence, you see him playing at Coachella. Hence, you see him selling out all these things. And I think it just means now that you've got much more diversion, I think, and people finding more access to music. So you're getting more love for it, I think.
I mean, with yourself, just one last thing is like, have you ever seen anyone as fucking hench as you behind the decks, basically? If you did Boiler Room, they'd have to clear a bit more space, wouldn't they? I mean, it sounds like I'm flirting now, but
yeah, it is. Listen, mate, we covered a lot of topics, a lot of penis, a lot of love. Have I ever seen? No, I tell you what. So Hodor from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
He's a DJ, a very, very good DJ, and he is 7 foot something. And I followed after one of my first DJ sets, Harper Adams University. He was on as the main headliner, and I was like, fuck me. He is, it's Christian Nahn, his name is. And he is
from Northern Ireland, right?
Northern Ireland, but lovely guy, Matt. But so he's the biggest dude. He was so big, he had to like lean back on something because he just like kinked in the middle because he's like 7 foot 1. So he's the only bloke so far apart from that famous Techno Viking on YouTube that people say that I look like, who does all the fun. You've seen it. YouTube, yeah, Techno Viking.
I haven't seen it, no.
I reckon, after this, get up, look at Techno Viking, because that's exactly what I look like. Just this aggressive Berlin, huge gear and all, like massive fucking, just doing it, proper techno German stuff. And someone like upsets him and he's like, gives him a look, I'm going to rip your fucking arms off. And then someone gives him a bottle of water and he just like technos off.
Well, that's it. No, I think that's the thing, is if they're not dancing, scare them into dancing. So the podcast, obviously, people should check that out. The book is, I mean, the book is, it's, it, I really loved reading the book. Remind us of the title of the book.
Yeah, so I've got there's a series of kind of two out, one called What Flanker, which is what you read, then I had a follow-up to that called Ruck Me. And I've got a book about kind of much more about mental health and performance and kind of some of the stuff we're talking about with council culture and how to navigate that. And that's called Approach Without Caution.
Okay, we'll check out all of those. And I'd love to, and this is the maybe the one and only time I'll be able to do this, is I could hype your DJ dates. Check out, it's good beer. Ocean Beach, which, you know, for the those of us with advancing years and beyond, it's all done and dusted by what, 11 p.m, something like that?
Yeah. So Ocean Beach is a full day party vibe. Diva Dance is taking them over every Monday in Ibiza. And then I've got my own event at a place called Rooftop 9 in San Antonio at Amelia Hotel, or Inside Hotel it's called, and it's called Sunset Sessions. Perfect way. Like I did the first one on Saturday, 7 till 10. Oh, classic house disco, building up to a nice bit of house. Everyone gets a few sherbets down and then they nip off for a night out and I go to bed. It's the perfect crime.
Beautiful. Well, James Haskell, thanks so much for being on What Most People Think.
Cheers, Jeff. Thanks, pal.
Okay, that was the chat with James. I hope you enjoyed that. And please, yeah, indulge me with the DJ chat. It's not often that I get to talk to somebody in the industry. And if you were just thinking, these sad old twats still thinking they're cool. Well, you're a sad old twat. What are you into, eh? Fucking with your train set. I bet you got some sad old butt. Well, you're still fishing, are you? What, you're a fucking subsistence farmer? We've all got sad, weird stuff. Okay, there's been a few reviews. Thanks very much for those. I'll read a few of those out now. What most people think. This is from C. Devin. All right, let's pick an accent for this. Let's just do one of those. You know, one of those women that you speak with that speaks like that, very officious voice. Hello. When the week has been tough, I can always rely on Jeff to make me laugh. Whenever his podcast drops, I listen to it, driving to and from work, and it always boosts my mood. Thanks, Jeff. That was basically, if you want to know what that accent was, it's called Auntie. This is from Dom Haslam. Dom, it's got to be a middle class guy. Jeff is to the sanctimonious woke what Harold Larwood was to the cricket team, the Australian cricket team in 1932. I say bold, well bold, Harold to Norcott, just as Douglas Jardine did to Larwood, as another Aussie batsman lay writhing in agony on the floor. I like the way it went angrier there, and I appreciate an extended cricket metaphor there. This is so Jeff. This is referring to last week's episode where I may have perved out a bit on Penny Mordaunt, perhaps. Jeff, bang on the money about the delectable Penny M. He has a firm grip, but... Oh, Jesus. Not so accurate about being at junction 10 of the M60. It was definitely the M65 between Blackburn and Burnley. Ah, right, yeah, I did wonder about that. The M60 is the Mancunian orbital motorway. I mean, in many ways, that is what most people think kind of prime... correspondence there is a bloke pulling me up in terms of stuff about motorways. This is from Disco Stew. Hey, love the show. And Jeff's work as your stand-up. Never takes the easy route with guests who share his opinions, and which gives great balance to the show and has changed my viewpoint on some subjects. All the while I piss myself laughing. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, the laughing is the reason for it, but maybe you just piss yourself. Maybe it's just coincidental. This is from The Punk and The Godfather. Maybe I have to do a sort of Billy Bragg type voice. I've listened to this podcast from the start and it remains my favourite podcast. Funny, informative, interesting guests with varied viewpoints and not too serious. Highly recommended. Okay, and this is from Jim Bean, who's given me a 5-star review, but had something to say about a recent guest who apparently was doing anti-English views on her own podcast. Well, you know, we all say mad shit on podcasts, but I'm glad that you gave me a 5-star review. I mean, I'm just such a desperate little bitch here. But thank you very much for listening to What Most People Think. And next week is episode 200. I've got a very special guest there, so do look out for that. Thank you for all the new reviews. Give James Haskell a follow, you know, give him some love, because, you know, the more really famous people come on here and find out, they get a bit of love back, they talk to all the other famous face. Who knows? I could be interviewing, who could I be interviewing? Give it a few years, I could be interviewing Tom Hanks. You know, I say that, I heard him on a podcast the other week, he was fucking boring. Anyway, speak to you next week.